Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
And welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. It's good to be back doing the podcast. I've had a patchy few weeks with the old virus and things like that, and so I've not been able to get out as many episodes as I kind of hope for. We've got a kind of like a really great season now, from kind of April to May and into June, coming up of interviews, so some really, really, really good guest speakers coming on. I'm returning to a topic. You might recall last year I did a recording on Mexico's kind of neoliberal moment, and for some bizarre reason it never properly recorded, and it was all a big hoo-ha. A big hoo-ha, I say, within sort of Explaining History listener circles, which is a fairly kind of niche and select bunch of people. Anyway, by popular demand, as if it was some kind of obscure Rolling Stones B-side, I'm re-recording it, and we're doing it again today. And the reason why I want to look at this is because I actually think a really neglected part of what we talk about is the 1990s. There's this assumption about the 1990s that, well, the Cold War had ended, things were relatively peaceable for a time, and it was a decade of relative tranquility and good times and things like that. Depends where you were, really. If you were in Yugoslavia, not so much. And the idea, and it's propagated by this sort of this false idea, this kind of Fukuyama idea of the end of history, that the great ideological struggles of the world are over, bar the shouting. There may be some little pockets of difficulties around the world here and there, but by and large, liberal democracy and free markets will now spread around the world, and that is the end of that. And there's not a great deal to be said that we will exist in this kind of historical moment that's just going to continue. Obviously, Fukuyama himself has kind of rejected all of that now, as subsequent events have shown us that obviously history doesn't end, and as Eric Hobsbawm said, history will go on as long as there are people. But the reason why Mexico is important in this is Mexico represented, firstly, a kind of one of neoliberalism's great achievements in the kind of the drawing in of a what would have been seen as a developing economy into the orbit of kind of neoliberal economics. And then it was a kind of a key failure as neoliberalism kind of collapsed in Mexico. So we're going to read from False Dawn by John Gray, which is a great book. John Gray himself, really, really fascinating thinker, often sort of claimed by both left and right as a kind of a key figure, but I don't think really kind of fits neatly into either category. But anyway, worth a read. So John Gray writes, on the morning of the 20th of December 1994, one of the world's most ambitious free market experiments aborted. Just 3 weeks after his inauguration, President Ernesto Zedillo of Mexico announced a devaluation of the country's currency. American investors who placed their savings in funds managed by firms such as Fidelity, Scudder, Goldman Sachs and Salomon Brothers lost over $30 billion. On the Mexican stock market, there was an estimated loss of $70 million in the stock market worth of Mexican corporations. In addition, Mexico suffered a loss of somewhere between 250,000 and 1 million jobs by the end of 1995. Capital flight on an unknown scale, a leap in annual inflation to over 50%, a rise in the cost of mortgages and loans far in excess of the inflation rate, and as a consequence, a rash of business and bank failures with a threat of bankruptcy overshadowing some state governments. What collapsed that day was more than a currency, it was an entire model of economic development. Prior to the devaluation, the Mexican experiment was held up as something to be emulated in developing countries throughout the world. This, I believe, is what was really important about Mexico in the early 1990s. It was the idea that if neoliberalism could be exported to a developing country, not from the kind of the core of the world's economies where it had sort of incubated, but to somewhere like Mexico, then this would be a kind of a model to export virtually everywhere else. Obviously, in some developing economies, places like Chile, that was a kind of the laboratory for neoliberalism under General Pinochet, done with extraordinary violence. Was an example of where it had been tried before, with fairly kind of disastrous economic effects. John Gray writes, anyway, animated by the Washington Consensus, the dogma that minimum government and free markets are achievable and desirable throughout the world, transnational organizations had attempted to implant in Mexico a variant of the American free market. A similar project was attempted in Thatcherite Britain and in Labour-governed New Zealand in the 1980s. In each case, despite major differences between these countries, the results were similar. The experiments were at best only very partial successes, but they wrought irreversible change on their societies. A global single market is very much a late 20th century political project. It is good to remind ourselves of this and to make an important distinction. This political project is far more transient than the globalization of economic and cultural life that began in Europe in the early modern period from the 15th century onwards, and is set to advance for centuries. For humankind, at the close of the modern period, globalization is an historical fate. Its basic mechanism is the swift and inexorable spawning of new technologies throughout the world. That technology-driven modernization of the world's economic life will go ahead regardless of the fate of a worldwide free market. Growing economic interconnectedness does not depend on the orthodoxies of the IMF. Only an ecological catastrophe can halt or retard it. Obviously, this book was written in the early 2000s, and I think that the chances of an ecological catastrophe retarding or halting global interconnectedness is significantly more likely now, to add a more pessimistic tone. Yet the consequences of this spread of modern means of production, writes John Gray, and communication throughout the world are practically the reverse of those that are confidently expected by the Washington Consensus. It means a metamorphosis of the American free market rather than its universal application, replication. It's more likely to engender a new international anarchy rather than recapture the supposed harmonies of the 19th century system. And it permits the appearance of new types of capitalism, most of which differ sharply from the free market. The most successful economies in the coming century will not be those that have tried to graft American free markets onto the stem of their native cultures. They will be economies whose modernization is indigenous. And we can see that in things like China. In David Harvey's Brief History of Neoliberalism, he writes about China having neoliberalism with Chinese characteristics, where essentially private ownership and massive consolidations of wealth and the exploitation of workers and the destruction of any kind of pay bargaining amongst workers. That's the bit that looks like Western neoliberalism. Everything else, where it involves state intervention and massive state coercion and the actual kind of extension of bureaucracy and the use of subsidies to allow Chinese companies to dump onto the international market, these are kind of highly illiberal aspects of Chinese capitalism. So what John Gray is saying there is that you will, this universalism was this kind of late 20th century fad, this idea that we would live in this kind of capitalist utopia where the market conditions in America are the same as in China or Mexico or Britain or Czechoslovakia or wherever else. And this is fantasy. The relentless exporting of capitalism won't mean you have a capitalism, you will have multiple capitalisms, each with their own regional flavour, and each creating not a kind of a globalised world, but a kind of a sort of a world of competing capitalism. John Gray writes, amongst recent experiments in engineering the free market in late 20th century conditions, those in Britain, New Zealand and Mexico are particularly notable. Each of them exemplifies, in the context of a particular national political culture, the ironies and paradoxes of the free market in the late modern world. In each, the initial impetus for the experiment was the fact that corporatist economic structures had become unsustainable. At the same time, neoliberal ideology came to be a powerful influence in its own right. In each case, economic globalization was the catalyst that triggered the neoliberal experiment. But the politics of insecurity, fueled by an expanding world economy, scattered the initial coalition of interests that propelled the experiment into power and weakened or destroyed the political vehicle that implemented it. As a result, the free market has used the power of the state to achieve its ends, but has weakened the institutions of the state in vital respects. In every case, free market policies lost political legitimacy, while at the same time altering the economy and society in ways that democratic choice cannot reverse. So just to unpack that for a moment, the kind of intellectuals of the neoliberal movement, and I've talked a lot about them recently, people who were pioneers of neoliberal thought from the 1930s onwards, people like, obviously, like Hayek and von Mises, believed that a moment of socio-economic and political crisis would come in particular in the United Kingdom and in the USA. And in that moment, when the kind of the Keynesian model of economics and that sort of post-war settlement no longer seemed to address the problems that were faced, then there would be an opportunity for a new extreme right-wing free market economic model to be introduced. This is essentially what happens with Margaret Thatcher's ascension to power, where high rates of inflation, union unrest, a seeming inability for Britain to compete in its manufacturing industries, which is greatly overstated, in fact, would present these sorts of opportunities. And what happened in the subsequent decade in all of the countries where neoliberalism was tried, that are studied in this chapter, when they were experienced, they were wildly unpopular with most of the population. Despite the kind of the hagiographies that are still written these days towards Margaret Thatcher and towards Ronald Reagan and to the other kind of key figures in the kind of the neoliberal historical moment, for the most part, the huge increases in unemployment, the reduction, the retreat of the state from providing basic services, the decline in the housing stock and the privatization of key industries has failed to find any sort of broad base of popularity. The key demographics who benefit are always those that own capital and assets, so people that own shares and people that have savings and people who have paid off their mortgages. They're very often the in countries where neoliberalism has been tried, people who have the fondest memories of figures like Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan. Anyway, we're going to dive back into Mexico now. So, John Gray writes, within weeks of the debacle in which its currency was devalued and Mexico was in danger of defaulting on its foreign debt, President Clinton assembled a $40 billion bailout for the Mexican government. It included around $20 billion in American loan guarantees, a financial aid package larger by far than any that the United States had ever considered for the transitional countries of the post-communist world. Not to suggest that Mexico was a post-communist country, of course. In addition, the United States insisted that the International Monetary Fund advance Mexico $18 billion, the largest IMF rescue operation ever mounted in the world. In January 1997, President Clinton hailed the bailout as an unprecedented success. On the 15th of January 1997, Mexico paid back the remaining portion of the emergency loan of $12.5 billion it had received in February 1995. At the same time, Mexican Finance Minister, Mr. Guillermo Ortiz, announced that Mexico was negotiating a new three-year borrowing program with the IMF. The reasons for the huge and uncharacteristically expeditious American commitment put together by President Clinton in January 1995 were fourfold. In the first place, it was considered necessary to prevent the tequila effect of stock market crashes and financial crises reaching beyond Latin America to Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia. Assisting Mexico was perceived to be vital in order to defuse a serious risk to the world's financial institutions. Second, the bailout may have forestalled substantial further losses by Americans whose pension savings had been invested in Mexico. It thereby limited the damage to American firms such as Salomon Brothers. Third, the salvage operation was judged to be unavoidable if deepening political instability in Mexico was to be prevented. Because President Clinton had staked his political fortunes on the success of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, signed between the US and Mexico in 1992, political upheaval in Mexico posed a major threat to his prospects in the 1996 presidential campaign. Mexico had an enormous strategic importance to the United States. According to the US Commerce Department, 1 year after the ratification of NAFTA, Mexico had become one of America's three largest trading partners, standing somewhere between Canada and Japan. It bought as many American goods as Russia, China, and most of Europe put together. One of the things that neoliberalism had done in Mexico during the kind of the years of the neoliberal experiment there was to turn up social pressures within Mexico. The immiseration of Mexican farmers, the expansion of Mexican cities, the growth of slums, and the cut in welfare programs, and all this kind of thing, led to a sense that Mexico was not as politically stable as it once had been. John Gray writes, Mexico had long been viewed from the north as a Latin American country of unique political stability. Of course, perceptions from the United States of South America in general did not tend to feature kind of ideas of political stability. And the general assumption is this: it was not a from kind of the Mexican border all the way down to the tip of Argentina, where it was not a continent famed for its stability. The realities of that notwithstanding, it was a country of unique political stability in which nothing ever happened. The rebellion of Mayan indigenous peoples in Chiapas, which began on New Year's Day 1994, posed a question mark over this legend of Mexican quiescence.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
An economic meltdown in Mexico might be a catalyst for further revolts. It could trigger a rerun of the Latin American debt crisis of 1982, perhaps on a larger and less controllable scale. A full-scale political collapse in Mexico would have incalculable implications for the USA. The fourth reason may have been weightier than all of the others. This, I think, is the most important one. Mexico was a showcase for the neoliberal market reform. It was the prime site for the American project of engineering the free market throughout the world. Since the early 1980s, it had a political elite obedient to the transnational financial organizations in which the American free market doctrines were institutionalized. Acting under the auspices of the International Monetary Fund, the government of Miguel de la Madrid from 1982 to 88 had launched a neoliberal austerity program of reduced government expenditure, wage and price controls, and privatization. You find this throughout the developing world in the 1980s, this economic orthodoxy, known as part of what was referred to as kind of the Washington Consensus, this idea that in order for countries to sort of balance their books and to budget responsibly, countries that needed to have, for example, IMF loans, had to pay those loans back, and they had to pay them back at the cost of cuts to social programs. There's a brilliant moment in at the very beginning of Debt, the First 5,000 Years by David Graeber, when he's talking to an economist about debt, and about somebody saying, this economist essentially saying that all debts had to be paid back. And he makes the point when Madagascar was loaned money by the IMF and forced to pay it back, it did it at the cost of cutting free healthcare, which led to the deaths of 20,000 children from malaria. And he challenged this economist on the morality of the repayment of debt. And the whole book is this kind of debate about where our ideas about debt and morality come from in the first place. It's a very, 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 very excellent read, by the way. Austerity, as kind of particularly Great Britain has discovered since 2010, has been throughout the history of neoliberalism an integral part. The kind of the shrinking of the public realm, the shrinking of public expenditure, which is believed in neoliberal philosophy to crowd out private enterprise and crowd out the kind of the effective workings of free markets, and also to place oppressive burdens of taxation on freeborn citizens and all that sort of stuff. It's really a way of shifting the burden of provision of services onto individuals to pay for, whereas once something might have been free at the point of use through taxation, then it becomes something one has to pay for from one's own income. Mexican accession to GATT, the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs, in 1985 signalled that the modernising faction of the governing PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party that had ruled Mexico for over six decades, had overridden its dinosaurs. There are countless examples of revolutionary parties or parties of the left or the centre-left by the 60s, 70s and 80s abandoning many of the kind of the articles of faith, and embracing the kind of the Washington Consensus. The General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs, now the World Trade Organization, was a device for kind of harmonizing world trade, for reducing trade barriers and reducing non-tariff barriers to trade, and making sure that there is sort of a free flow of goods and services. One's joining the GATT, as it was at the time, was a clear signal of this kind of idea of modernization. Very often, the adoption of pro-business policies, policies that benefit capital, is referred to as modernization. How much it modernizes conditions for the slum dwellers is highly debatable. Mexico's modernizers had accepted that the quasi-autarkic economic policies of the past would be increasingly costly in the global economic climate they foresaw. So lots of the time, I mean, obviously when we talk about autarky, there's this idea of kind of national self-sufficiency and a refusal to accept the unfair realities of trade, and to try to kind of protect certain industries to foster self-sufficiency and that kind of thing. And it's been obviously tried and largely unsuccessfully throughout modern history. But there were various kind of modernizers, various people in Mexico and in other countries who, as globalization got into its kind of stride in the 80s and 90s, saw that there, it looked a kind of, shall we say, realistically, that there was little likelihood of autarkic policies thriving. The government of President Carlos Salinas de Gortari, from 1988 to 94, was hailed as a model of successful modernization by all sectors of American opinion. In its aptly named conventional wisdom section of the American magazine Newsweek, portrayed Mexico at the end of 1993 as having been transformed by NAFTA into a US Sunbelt state. And if you just consider the ideological and political implications of that statement being seen as a kind of a relatively common sense bit of conventional wisdom, that this part of Mexico has essentially become sort of Greater America, for, you know, unofficially, that in itself is quite a fascinating observation. American business and political elites were confident that Mexico had modernized. It did not occur to them that the economic modernization for Mexico could mean anything other than the assimilation into American business culture, that the Mexican bourgeoisie and Mexican capital become little American clones. They saw the devaluation crisis of 1994 as a temporary setback in the coupling of two countries under an American free market regime. Mexico became a neoliberal experiment that could not be allowed to fail. In setting aside generations of nationalism and protectionism in Mexico for a free trade agreement with the United States, the Salinas government was not only recognizing the reality that Mexico's semi-autarky had become unsustainable, in staking its own political fortunes on a wager that the neoliberal model of economic development was workable in Mexico, it was also gambling with Mexico's political stability. The quintessentially absurd notion that a country which, in the words of one of Mexico's most acute political thinkers, radically, substantively, and ferociously different from the United States, could be in less than a decade modernized on an American model, has become accepted as an established fact. So here we have, and we see this throughout the 20th century, the kind of the triumph of fantasy over reality. And in some ways that's a kind of one of ideology's defining features, conquest of reality by magical thinking. Mexico's was and always has been a radically different country in terms of its political culture, its economy, the way in which its elites and its people see the world. It's been a radically different country to America because it has had a radically different historical journey to America, which seems trite and seems obvious. But when you're attempting to export quite a recent political and economic model that is gestated in America into Mexico, and hoping that will take hold, and hoping that will lead to a kind of like a transnational transformation in ideas and ethos and attitude, particularly as it regards not just the workings of politics, but the structure of society, how people live, how things are paid for, how goods are provided, how basic needs are met, and that will happen without anybody becoming particularly upset about that. This is an evangelism. It is sort of trying to sort of export capitalism with almost kind of like a missionary sort of zeal. Not to suggest, obviously, Mexico didn't have capitalism, but it has its own kind of variant of it. According to one account, writes John Gray, newly established Mexican branches of the American video store Blockbusters shelved American films along with Mexican films. Only Latin American and European films were categorized as foreign, neatly capturing the American belief that Mexico and the United States had, for all practical and cultural purposes, fused into one. The political risks of neoliberal economic reform cannot be perceived by those who imagine that the institutions of the free market and democratic government operate in a natural equilibrium. hardly glimpsed in the United States, these risks had long been understood by Mexico. They were clearly grasped by the principal architect of the free market in Mexico, President Carlos Salinas. In an interview published in late 1991, Salinas drew attention to the misguided linkage between economic restructuring, perestroika, and political liberalization, glasnost, in the reform program by President Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, implying that it may have been responsible for the Soviet collapse. Freedoms of what you call glasnost kind, of the glasnost kind, have existed for decades in Mexico. When you're introducing strong economic reform, you must make sure that you build political consensus around it. If you are at the same time introducing additional drastic political reform, you may end up with no reform at all. And we want to have reform, not a disintegrated country. These remarks may explain why until 1989, Salinas opposed the Free Trade Pact, which in February 1990 he announced he would seek with the United States. Evidently, Salinas had understood well the political risks of the market reform in Mexico, and his American mentors had not. Okay, so there we're going to leave it today. I'm really glad that we managed to kind of actually talk about Mexico. And there's a bunch of stuff I want to say on the subject going forward, so I'll leave you there. I'm away next week, and then the week after we'll be getting into some of the interviews that we have lined up for you in the coming months. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, and thanks everyone for your ongoing support. We've been doing this podcast for a long time now, and so it's always really grateful when I hear from people and they find that the podcast is useful for them. Take good care, everyone. All the best. Bye-bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.